From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Late last month, some very particular numbers started appearing in public, in blog posts mostly at first. They were the numbers of gay Latter-day Saints who were said to have committed suicide because of the LDS Church's recent policy declaring those in same-sex marriages apostates. 26 was the number cited in Utah. But it turns out it's difficult to substantiate those numbers, and for various reasons. The motives for suicide are incredibly complex. That's one. Another reason is that suicide numbers aren't actually collected that way. Okay, so the numbers are hard to pin down, but suicide researcher Phil Rogers says when you get bogged down in numbers, you miss a broader point. Some people are genuinely hurting because of the Mormon policy. So we're talking about what we know about its effects and what we should say about the numbers. Join us after the news.
Still thinking about that conversation on StoryCorps? Or the story you caught last weekend on Snap Judgment? The voices you hear on public radio stay with you. You can have a lasting effect on public radio, too. KUER sustainers give ongoing monthly contributions, providing a steady stream of income so we can continue to bring you the programs you can't get out of your head. Become a sustainer today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So it should be a simple question. If you're gay, does your religion make it more or less likely that you'll attempt to kill yourself over despair or alienation? Same goes for the recent policy of the LDS Church that calls same-sex couples who choose to get legally married apostates. Simple question. Has that policy caused people to attempt suicide? Should be easy to figure this stuff out, right? You just make a tally. But turns out, and no surprise here, it's complicated. The reason anyone decides to take their own life. One study from USC last year found that gays and lesbians who remain in their church, whatever that church is, actually have less of a risk of suicide because churches are often where you find your support group, your family and your friends. But the study also found that leaving your faith because of conflict also meant you were more than 2 times more likely to try and commit suicide. You see, those statistics blend together and seem to cancel each other out, and it's hard to account for profound feelings of sadness and trauma. Late last month, advocates of LGBT Mormons suggested they had been able to uncover a very particular number of people who had committed suicide as the result of this new Mormon policy. That number was 26 people. But for the reason I mentioned a moment ago, it's been difficult to substantiate that number. So today we're going to try and figure out what we can say about the effect of the Mormon policy on gay Latter-day Saints. It's a story that's more than just about numbers. So we invite you to join us. 801-585-WEST is the number, 801-585-9378. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. John Gustav Rothel is joining us. He's president of Affirmation. It's a support group for LGBT Mormons. He also teaches American religious history at United Theological Seminary in Minnesota. We should mention that he himself is a gay man who has been excommunicated from the LDS Church, though he is still active in his ward. He joins us from a studio in Minneapolis. And John Gustav Rothel, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug. I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Philip Rogers is with us, a suicidologist, vice president of design development and evaluation for Living Works. That's a company that trains organizations in suicide prevention. Before that, he was an evaluation scientist for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. He also happens to be a member of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and he's joining us from his office in Rutland, Vermont. And Dr. Rogers, welcome to you.
Thank you, Doug. It's good to be here.
Kendall Wilcox is back with us, co-chair of the Utah Commission on LGBT Suicide Awareness and Prevention, part of the Suicide Prevention Coalition. He's an independent filmmaker, as you may or may not know, working on a project called Far Between, which explores what it means to be gay and Mormon. He's also creator of a discussion group called Circles of Empathy. And we should mention, if you don't know, Wilcox is gay and also an active member of the LDS Church. And Kendall Wilcox, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Doug.
Okay, I'm not sure how much time to spend on the story that, I mean, clearly it's the reason we're talking about all of this, but Kendall Wilcox, let me start with you. The story as it's been playing out over the last week or so, late last month, there's a group called Mama's Dragons. It's a support group for the families of gay Latter-day Saints, and it was the one that actually had come up with this sort of tally. 26 suicides in Utah, a couple more outside, 32 I think it was altogether. And they were very particular about the numbers, 23 males, one female, two transgendered people, all of them in between that really crucial sort of teenage time, at least 14 to 20, I think it was, six others in other states. Where did they come up with those numbers? What do we know about the fact that there are numbers?
Yeah, I think I can speak to that, actually.
Okay. Is this John?
Is John.
Okay, John, we'll identify your name as we go, but maybe introduce yourself for the first few moments. Go ahead.
Sure. Okay, so all of those numbers that you just cited actually came from one individual, and it wasn't – this individual is very active in the Mama Dragons support community, and this wasn't like an official finding of Mama Dragons or anything like that, but this individual is very prominent in the Mama Dragons community, and – she's very well known. She's featured in a documentary about family support for LGBT Mormons, and so she's very widely known. And essentially, what had happened was she reported that in the months since the policy, many people had come to her wanting to talk, distressed, upset because family members had committed suicide. I believe she told me 8 or 9 of the people who talked to her were parents. A lot of them were siblings. Some were more extended family members, cousins or grandparents, and so on. And so she basically that's where those numbers came from. That was the number of people who, within that time period, had spoken to her about this.
Right.
She wasn't always able to get a lot of detail. For example, she didn't necessarily ask them, what date did this happen, or, so she didn't have a lot of really, she didn't always have good information that we could map to public health data. So that's been kind of a problem. But that's where those numbers came from.
Okay. So what do we know about, Peggy Fletcher Stack in the Salt Lake Tribune wrote an extensive, terrific article, I have to say, breaking all of this down to some degree. What do we know about the reality then, John, if you can tell us? Okay, so it wasn't 26 exactly in Utah. Can we even identify a number, or is that, as you say, problematic?
Well, it's very difficult. And what we do know is that the public health data for those 2 months don't necessarily corroborate the number that was reported for Utah.
Yeah.
But again, I got some clarification from the individual who had reported this, and she couldn't swear that some of these suicides didn't happen before the policy, for example.
Right.
So, but one of the things I've been talking about is the fact that because it's so difficult to tell if a death is a suicide from public health data, it often will not be reported as such. There might be a death, and we wouldn't know that the individual is LGBT,
right?
Because that wouldn't be public information. And so
they don't break it down that way. I mean, I guess they don't do that in Utah, and they don't do that around the country. They don't break it down in terms of your sexual orientation or certainly your religion, I suppose. Is that right?
And Not yet. That's right.
Right.
But I think even if they tried to get that data, it would be difficult to get.
Yeah.
It's
hard to pin this down, basically.
It's hard to pin this down. And you're talking about, families are going through intense grief when this is happening. And so, whether anybody is able to talk about it, that's sort of a question or an issue there as well. But, it seems to me that just because of the nature of this anecdotal evidence, and by anecdotal, I mean, individuals coming forward and saying this happened to us or this happened to me. No systematic effort to go out there and collect data in a systematic or scientific way. We just have individuals saying this happened.
Yeah.
But that anecdotal data sometimes may be the only data that we have.
Right, right.
To
get a conversation going, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, and in that sense, it's important, just in that sense. I want to talk about, because we have to get this out of the way, and this is something I'm guessing you're all three particularly concerned about, and that is the danger of talking about suicide in general. Kendall, there's a term I've heard called suicide contagion. Is that a term that we can apply here and talk about the concern that you and others may have about that?
I would think so, and I would absolutely defer to Phil Rogers on this. I mean, he is the expert on that. So, but within the LGBT Mormon community, that's become an increasing concern, as particularly as this story has rolled out and, in a sense, snowballed, right, from a few Facebook posts to national headlines in magazines like The Advocate, where the headlines have, as is the nature of headlines, been reductionist and oversimplistic, which is actually very dangerous when we're talking about individuals who are already in a depressed state, prolonged depressed state, and therefore at risk. And the slightest suggestion, the slightest nod towards, yeah, it does seem like death is a better option, which they're already feeling.
Other people are, in fact,
exactly,
going through with it.
Have a headline suggest and even complete a sort of internal logic to a narrative like, well, this plus this equals I must. Yeah, everybody else is doing it. So there's a big concern in our community.
Dr. Rogers, how does it work? Is that a proper term, contagion?
Contagion is absolutely the proper term. And it's a bit of a fine line because we need to be able to talk openly about suicide, to in part bring it out of the shadows, to reduce the stigma related to help seeking and help giving. But there's a fine line in this regard. Along with suicide numbers in context, I think we need to offer messages of hope and availability of help, and I haven't seen a lot of that. Let me provide one example. I've seen this on social media. It was a tally of suicide deaths that used that original number and that added numbers to that as more, quote-unquote, reports of suicide deaths of LGBT youth came up. So you would see this on social media, and you would see this number going up in terms of reported or alleged deaths of LGBT young people. And this would set sort of an expectation that if you're young and you're LGBT and you're struggling a little bit, that maybe suicide is a normative response to that. And that's what we fear, that sort of expectation that because I'm struggling with this issue and I don't see any resources and it appears to be getting worse, that I myself may or should consider suicide.
Hey, go ahead.
I was going to say, just to sort of add a personal punch to that, having gone through this myself repeatedly and still, in a sense, I'm a suicide survivor, right? I can testify to that just hearing the numbers of other people alone was one more tip of the scales in my mind, because I knew that suicide is an option. It exists. So don't insult my intelligence by saying it's never an option, which well-meaning people do say. But in reality, don't insult my intelligence. I know it is, but I want people to address my ability and responsibility to make decisions with my life and what the cards I've been dealt. And so it is an option, but it's an option I can choose not to take. But please don't also flood my airwaves with suggestions that it is the only option, that everybody else is doing it, so I should too.
John Gustav Rothel, this was your story too, was it not? I think it was 1986 you attempted suicide?
I didn't attempt, but I had a plan. I was very close to committing suicide, and fortunately had an encounter with a neighbor who happened to be an Episcopal priest who kind of helped me through this. Yeah.
And you were contemplating it because of where you fit in. You were Mormon at the time. Is that right?
I was an active Mormon. Yep. I had completed a mission for the church. I was at BYU. And at that point, it looked to me like I was going to lose my faith and my whole world. I couldn't see how I fit within the program of the LDS Church, and that was so painful to me. I wanted to fit. I wanted to belong, and it was just looking more and more impossible to me. And that was at the root of my depression. And, you know, just there was just a lot of pain. And there came a point for me where I felt so isolated, and I was pulling away from people. And then there was kind of a critical moment where I went and talked to my bishop about some stuff that was going on for me. I didn't completely come out to him and tell him that I was gay, but as a result of that conversation with my bishop, my temple recommend was taken away. I had originally gone into interview for calling, and I was told I couldn't hold that calling. I was told I couldn't take the sacrament anymore for a time. And at that point, I walked out of his office feeling like if this is the result of this conversation with him as a gay man, I am never, ever going to be a worthy member of the church. And so for me at that point, it looked like there was no possibility of inclusion and connection within the church. And that was really the point where I started to seriously think about suicide.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that really sort of brings us back to what this is all about. You know, it's about connection. People have to feel connected to other people. When you're starting to feel so, you're like in this black hole, and you feel like if you reached out to somebody that they wouldn't reach back, they wouldn't take your hand. I mean, that's how it feels to you. It feels you're just like in this place where it doesn't feel like there's anything you can do, and that is, you know, literally, I was saved because somebody reached out to me.
Isn't it a little ironic that the person who reached out to you was a religious person, but from a different faith? Like, and so what did this Episcopal, was it, did you say it was Episcopal priest?
Episcopal priest,
what did he say to you?
You know, I, basically, he just told me his story. Sorry, getting a little emotional here. You know, he told me a story, and he told me about his relationship with God. And he had been an alcoholic. He'd gone through, you know, incredible upheaval in his life and had really been in a bad place. And he told me a story about God reaching out to him and saving him. And that gave me hope. And from that moment on, for months I had not been able to pray because I thought God rejected me. And when he told me that story, I began to pray again. And so I slowly was able to, you know, begin to make some of those connections that are so essential. You know, what we do in affirmation is, at a lot of our conferences, we talk about four things. We talk about your self-acceptance, acceptance of yourself, your relationship with God, your relationships with family, and your relationship with your community of faith, with your church. It's all about connection, right? It's all of those connections that are going to be our lifelines, really, and that are going to, you know, provide us a context to figure things out. I mean, the policy and church doctrine, it presents tremendous difficulties for LGBT people.
Right.
And so it takes work to figure it out. If we have a supporting community and if we foster these relationships with God, with our families, with our churches, that provides us a very strong framework to try to find answers to these very difficult questions.
But how can you have a strong framework for family and friends within a church structure, within the LDS church structure, when the official policy is that people who make a choice to have sexual relationships and or get married are right. apostates? Can they fit?
Yeah, well, that is part of the core problem. And, you know, I mean, this problem existed before the policy.
Yeah.
Right. So, and this is something that I'd been telling people all along is that.
But doesn't
you know,
it make it official now, John? Doesn't it make it official now? Everyone always assumed that you would be an apostate, but now there's a piece of paper that says you are.
Even more.
Yes, I think that's the bottom line, right? That's the effect of the policy. But that question was still there. You know, it was still something that people struggled with before, and it continues to be. And you know, I trust that there will be answers that will be more satisfying than the answers we have right now. For me, that's an act of faith. And I'm able to stay active in the church and I believe in the church and I'm active, but it's because I have this foundational relationship with God and I have a trust in God. And you know, my first experience, the first thing I did after the policy, the next morning I just woke up. It was like I had a post-policy hangover and I felt terrible. And I got up in the morning and I got down on my knees and I started to pray and I asked God and I just felt a peace. I felt God saying, this is going to be okay and I'm going to be with you.
John, can I ask you a very particular question about that experience?
Sure.
Are you thinking, and Kendall, maybe you can sound off on this too, are you thinking that this in fact is God's will right now? This is something that Elder Russell Nelson said recently. This is not just some policy. This is revelation. This is God. So is your thinking that your leaders, although well-intentioned and you may love and support, have blown it on this one, and God, of course, did not intend to leave you out? Or do you think, in fact, in some way, for whatever, you know, inexplicable reason, God right now isn't ready for same-sex marriage to be part of the Mormon church? Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, I don't know if Kendall wants to try.
Kendall, you start. Let John work that through. I know you and I have talked about this before.
Right.
God's will.
Just to be totally honest and clear, I have not received any sort of personal revelation or confirmation that this is the will and mind and will of God. That said, I also don't pretend to know the mind and will of God. I'm saying I have not received that. I believe President Nelson when he says in his feelings as an apostle of the church that this is the mind and will of God. I believe he believes that.
Yeah.
I don't know if it truly is.
Right.
I personally see all the hurt and the damage that it has caused. I personally read it as so punitive and draconian in tone and approach that it does not match what I personally come to understand what is Christ-like behavior, teaching true doctrines that are imbued, though, with Christ-like virtues of empathy, kindness, and compassion. I don't see those present in this, so I don't. But again, I do believe that he believes it.
John, let me come back to you for a moment because I want to bring Dr. Rogers back into the conversation on this particular point. This idea that how does something so crucial as to your own relationship with God and what you think God intends for you, how important is that in the scheme of things for those who are sort of on that bubble, on that tipping point, contemplating something so drastic?
Oh, I think it's so important. For me, that was always the crux.
Yeah.
For me, is to feel connected to God, and you know, one of my greatest fears was becoming disconnected from God. You know, my life as a Latter-day Saint had always involved frequent prayer, and you strive to feel the Spirit in your life. And you try to live by the Spirit. And when you lose the Spirit, that's something that you try to address. You try to figure out, what have I done wrong so that I've lost the Spirit? And you try to get back in line with God so that you can be in that place. And so that was one of the greatest fears for me as I was starting to come to terms with this, you know, as a teenager and then later as a young adult, was this fear that this would somehow cut me off from God. And so that was, you know, that was critical. And what I've found is that in general, the individuals who are doing well in their church communities are also the people who have that sort of foundational sense and that divine connection that helps them navigate some of the difficulties, you know, in terms of
right
doctrine and policy and whatnot.
Dr. Rogers, did you understand my question before?
Could you repeat it, please?
Well, I just wanted to say what you're hearing from Kendall and John now.
Okay.
And the effect that that has on people who are really, as I said, on the verge of a drastic decision about whether they'll, you know, attempt suicide.
I think at the core of every suicide death is pain and hopelessness. And I think you got a sense of that type of pain when John was relating some of his early experiences.
Yeah.
But you got a sense of that hopefulness when he talked about his connectedness, you know, the way he was connected with his church community and with leaders and with members and others and with his trust in God. Considering those two factors, you know, if we want to prevent suicide, we really want to reduce the pain and increase the hopefulness. And I think particularly in the case of young LGBT individuals, having someone like Kendall and having someone like John as role models, people they can look up to that have been through that experience, have experienced that pain, have experienced some of that hopelessness, and have been able to work through that and come to a place in their lives where suicide is no longer an issue, but they seem to be vibrant and successful and contributing members of the society and flourishing in many ways. I think that's an incredible model for young people to have who are struggling with these issues. And I applaud them for doing that.
We need to take a break. That's Philip Rogers, a suicide researcher with the group Living Works. He's joining us from his office in Vermont. John Gustav Rothel is president of Affirmation. It's a support group for LGBT Mormons, joining us from Minneapolis. And Kendall Wilcox is here with us in studio, co-chair of the Utah Commission on LGBT Suicide Awareness and Prevention and director of the ongoing film project Far Between. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking, are gay Mormons killing themselves over the new LDS policy that labels those in same-sex marriages as apostates? Recently, an advocacy group reported an alarming number of suicides that have happened since the policy was put in place, but it's been difficult to substantiate those numbers because, of course, this is an incredibly complex issue. So today, we're trying to sift through all the layers and figure out what we can say about depression and suicide among gay Mormons and what part the church's policy has been playing in all of this. Kendall Wilcox is with us, along with John Gustav Rothel, and we have Dr. Philip Rogers, a suicidologist with Living Works. It's a company that trains organizations in suicide prevention. Okay, Dr. Rogers, back to you. I wanted to ask you, is the rate of suicide. This surprised me a little bit. There have been a few studies, one from USC in particular. There's another one, a so-called Ad Health database study that found that gay teens, the rate of suicide for gay teens is actually lower if they're involved in a religion. Do you know what you can say about that?
I'm familiar with some of that literature, and I think clearly, and this is related back to some of what John has said his experience is that membership in a faith community, in a religion, in a church is generally protective. It's a connection that's vital to individuals. You're connected to a purpose in life. You're connected to leaders in that church, to individuals, to social networks that are related to that church. And that forms sort of a protective factor against suicide. And that's, I think, in the lead up to this, cited some of the research by Jeremy Gibbs at USC that found that young LGBT folks who may be conflicted and may have some conflict at church over their sexual orientation and perhaps church doctrine or the way that they're treated, and ultimately leave the church, are at higher risk for suicide because they sever those connections that are so protective.
Kendall Wilcox, what do you make of that? On one hand, that provides a sort of comforting connection. You leave because you're in conflict, because your church has called you an apostate, or because you can't quite make work it out. And as you know, that's happening a lot. So you leave, and I mean, it's just, it's like a catch-22, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think we need to dig deeper into those numbers and what the narrative behind them, what's really going on, because, on the one hand, we can find, I think it is indisputable that we do find hope and connection within our faith community when all the right elements are in place. And even, again, like those numbers say, for LGBT individuals as well. I am absolutely not disputing that there is a large swath of the LGBT or same-sex attracted community within the LDS church who find great comfort and community within the church and hope. You know, that's their byword, is they have hope. But there is also a huge segment that, for many, many different reasons, don't find a connection to that sense of hope and community. They do get those underlying messages of exclusion and rejection. And so, in a sense, their remaining in the pews actually has an adverse effect, because it actually compounds their sense of hopelessness, because they are getting the message within the source of hope itself that there is no hope. So,
if I can interject just quickly.
Yeah.
Make a note about research. Research is generally based on averages, but mm-hmm. no one is average.
Right.
So
that's
for
what makes
some,
this so difficult, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. For some, it might be safer to stay. For others, to separate. I think the practical implications, the clinical implications of this research is that we should not assume that even if someone is having conflict or difficulty in church between their sexual orientation and how they're treated or doctrine, that it's best for them to leave. We cannot make that assumption. So that's the bottom line, the takeaway from that research.
Okay, so John, let me ask you, because I think this is interesting. Mm-hmm. So you are married.
Yes.
I've been
in this relationship for over 23 years.
Right.
And we've been legally married since 2008.
Okay. Now, you and your husband go to church. Yeah,
he occasionally comes to church with
me. Okay, so let me talk about the times when he occasionally goes with you. You sit in the pew.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And how are you treated? What does the ward say? What does the bishop say? Especially since the policy, obviously.
Right. I've been active in my ward for over 10 years now. And people know me. They know my situation. They know who I am. And most members of my ward by this time have gotten to know my husband and have met him and know who he is. And if you ever meet him, he's just a delightful person. And everybody who meets him immediately falls in love with him. And you know, mm-hmm. folks in my ward have been the same way. He came to church with me, the Sunday after the policy. And we had a number of people who came up and wanted to talk with him and were just very supportive of us as individuals. And in the sense that, you know, they love us and they accept us as friends, as we are. And, there's no sense of judgment. People aren't, saying, well, the church says this, and so,
Wait, really? Not even since the policy? That didn't sort of change the conversation, change a bit?
Well, the Sunday after the policy, there were several people who came up to me and just were hugging me and said, I just want you to know that I love you, and I feel terrible, and
Wait,
what was that?
Right, but what did that mean? Were they saying, I'm really sorry God has this intent for you? Or, I think the leaders got this wrong and I'm really sorry. We'll figure this out eventually.
Well, I'm sure that there were people across the spectrum of attitudes in terms of that. And I know from having talked to my bishop and to other people in my ward that there are people in the ward who think that the policy is wrong, and who don't like it, and then there are people who are sure that it's right, and then there are people who are kind of in between and are trying to figure things out and don't know quite what to make of it. But, you know, one of the things that I was going to say to this earlier conversation is that the best situations that I've seen is, say you have a gay youth in your ward who, and maybe a few people in the ward know that he's gay. Maybe he's out to his family, maybe a couple of close friends, and maybe to his bishop. And the best practice that I've seen is when church leaders will, you know, sort of sit down with a youth and will say, this is incredibly difficult. This is a very difficult situation that you're in, and we just want you to know that we love you unconditionally, and we want you to be happy, and we want you to make good choices in your life, and we will be there to support you. I've seen that happen in LDS congregations, and that is a huge thing. It doesn't take away the problem. It doesn't take away the larger issue of, you know, you've got a policy here that is going to be really problematic if you want to establish a relationship with a member of the same sex. It doesn't take any of that away, but it reinforces the sense that we're here with you, and we want you to be happy, and those kinds of situations. That's ideal. The really bad situations are the situations where people pull back, where their church leaders don't know quite how to deal with them, and so they don't say anything at all, or what they do say is sort of uninformed and makes the situation worse, makes people feel more isolated, right? And then that kind of starts that snowball effect of, you know, people just gradually pull back more and more and lose those connections that are so important.
Well, Kendall, talk about that, because I think that's interesting. It seems like, okay, it's great. It seems like John's ward is embracing and loving. And there are, I imagine there are a number of places, and I don't want to sort of distinguish them through ideology, but, you know, I think a lot of Latter-day Saints know that your liberal wards and conservative wards. And, you know, you go into rural areas or in the suburbs, and they tend to be a little bit more conservative in their ideology. So what happens if you're a gay person in Sandy or Layton? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It depends. And I would add to that layer of complexity that you just elucidated, that another component that we have to recognize in this conversation, especially at this point as we're analyzing these anecdotes, is the relative importance of privilege. The privilege that each LGBT individual member of the church brings into their life experience. Meaning, for example, using John, he's a very kind, very intelligent, educated white man who's not 14 years old, right? So he brings all of that, and I'm not saying he's privileged, therefore he doesn't count. I am not saying that. I'm just saying it's relative, and that we need to acknowledge that when we hold up a beautiful example like John's, we cannot say it and then to walk away and say, see, all Mormons can be accepting. We have to say, wait. John brings with him relative privilege that maybe a 14-year-old that comes from maybe a slightly fractured home or whatever the scenario might be that lacks those advantages brings into this scenario and therefore is not able to garner that kind of support from their faith community.
And that's important to say that exists. Right. People are still being kicked out of their houses.
Absolutely.
And things like that.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Dr. Rogers, you want to say something before we head to a break about any of that?
You know, I think it just reiterates the point that, you know, for young people who are struggling with these issues, that outcomes can be a lot more positive if they are supported by church members and leaders and friends and family. That support, that social support, that support at church is critical to positive outcomes for these young people.
So the question that I want to get to when we get back from a break is, can you have both?
Both.
Both the idea of support within a ward community and an official policy that regards people as apostates if they fulfill their sexual selves?
Good question.
Yeah. Let's talk about that when we get back from a break. Dr. Philip Rogers is with us. He is a suicide researcher with the group Living Works. Kendall Wilcox, of course, there, a co-chair of the Utah Commission on LGBT Suicide Awareness and Prevention. And we have John Gustav Rothel with us, president of Affirmation. It's a support group for LGBT Mormons. He's joining us from Minneapolis. We'll take a break and be back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are asking the question whether gay Latter-day Saints are attempting suicide over the new LDS policy that labels those in same-sex marriages as apostates. That's the sort of candid way to lay out that question, although it's terribly complicated, substantiating the numbers and talking about the effects of all of this. We're giving it a shot, though, today with John Gustav Rothel, president of Affirmation, a support group for LGBT Mormons. We have Kendall Wilcox, co-chair of the Utah Commission on LGBT Suicide Awareness and Prevention with us. And Philip Rogers is with us. He's a suicide researcher with a group called Living Works. He's joining us from his office in Vermont. Okay, Kendall Wilcox, to that question, because you've talked about there being an internal inconsistency here that has to be sort of worked out. Would you explain that?
And it's sort of a disconnect on the part of leadership in the church and frankly, the public relations department of the church as well, in terms of really being able to get at the heart of accepting the fact, and I do think it is a fact, that there is a disconnect between the twofold messaging of the church on this issue, which is the doctrine says chastity, marriage, and family are defined in this specific way, and anything outside of that needs to be considered sin and apostasy. So that's the first part of the message. The second part is, but we love you. Christ loves you. Heavenly Father loves you. And they have a very hard time at acknowledging that is extremely hard for people to internalize, not just in the abstract, but in the lived experience. How do you live that on a day-to-day basis? How do you live that and inhabit that?
No, you're celibate, right?
Sure, that's in a super simplistic way.
Yeah.
But how do you live with it from day to day, moment to moment, when you see a man across the way that you're attracted to, and you have to remind yourself, no, I have to choose. I'm not just abstaining. No, I am proactively choosing to not engage in social, pro-social, positive mental health behaviors included in pair bonding in order to not become an apostate. Trying to internalize a message of, but we love you and you are loved, it's so hard to internalize that. I'm sorry. And that's where I would challenge the church to really dig into and find better ways and really emphasize that half of the twofold message. I think we're clear on the doctrine.
Right. But how do they do that without ditching the policy?
Right. And I know that is, from my sources, that is the one of the number one concerns is the brethren consider themselves the custodians of the doctrine, right? That's one of their number one jobs, is to be custodians of the doctrine. And I believe in that, and I believe that that is sincere. But part of the doctrine is love. And that's not just a mamby-pamby nice little idea. That is the core of Christian doctrine. And so we have to acknowledge, meaning within the church, we have to acknowledge that this messaging that has been supported by the enacting of the policy overshadows. It effectively overshadows the core message of the doctrine of Christ, which is we love one another and we love God. So we need to do better.
Yeah, you know, I would say too, because it's not just a question of, you know, seeing some guy across the way and feeling attracted to him.
Right.
I mean, this is about the most fundamental kind of human connection that it's possible for somebody to have. And human connection and family are really at the core of our faith as Latter-day Saints. It's so important. So there's a huge question for LGBT folks, for gay and lesbian folks, about how do I fit within this scheme of family, and how does, you know, how does the sense of connection that I feel, and I'm talking about me personally, me specifically as a gay man who has this relationship with my husband that feels blessed to me, that it feels to me like God is with us in this relationship, that the relationship is a blessing of God, and that my commitment to my husband is sacred to me. And there have been so many blessings that have come out of that, and the way that it connects me and my husband to our respective families, and the roles that we're able to play, and the kinds of service that we're able to perform as a family, and all of this stuff is interconnected. And when I look at the official doctrine, it's hard for me to see, you know, where I fit within that scheme. So that's, you know, that's a core challenge, and that's a fundamental challenge. But as I said before, you know, the policy didn't change that. The policy, if anything, just made it more painfully clear and more painfully obvious that we have this, we do have a gap in terms of the doctrine. The doctrine does really well at sort of explaining, you know, what your destiny is if you are heterosexual. To me, doesn't seem, you know, it seems like there's more information needed for people who are in my situation.
Dr. Rogers, I want to ask you about where are the trends headed? I think a lot of people are talking about the fact that it's hard to quantify some of this, but it does seem like the trends are headed toward more people contemplating suicide because of social alienation and all of these kinds of things. Is that in fact true? And I would have thought that in an era when you're seeing more, it seems anyway, more cultural, more social acceptance of LGBT people and their lives, that the opposite would be true. What do we know?
We know it's complicated.
Yeah.
And
we do know that.
Yeah. And I'm not sure we have an easy answer to that question. I think some of the indication is that with greater knowledge and light on this subject, that we're providing more support for LGBT youth, and that's can reduce their suicide risk. But with more LGBT youth coming out, being in the open, if you will, about their sexuality, it also increases the amount of conflict that they come in contact with, and thus increasing their risk. So it's sort of a two sides of the same coin right there. There are some positives, but there are also some negatives. And I don't think we have an idea or indication of the trend right now, but that's something we're working at and looking at right now.
And can I just say that part of what contributes to that or increases the negative effects of that conflict is how our community at large reacts and behaves around this conversation, meaning how the LDS Church responds to the conflict and how LGBT rights organizations respond to the conflict. There's this African saying that I will butcher, but the meaning is when elephants fight, it's the tender herbs under the feet that are hurt. So when we've got these giants arguing with each other in media, the individuals underneath it, those of us who are actually experiencing it, aren't being addressed. And so how that conflict is played out via culture wars actually can account for why we are seeing an uptick.
One of the things, go ahead.
If I can interject quickly here, we talk about this conflict. I should mention Caitlin Ryan's work with the Family Acceptance Project that provides excellent evidence-based resources for family members, church members, and particularly leaders on how they can better support LGBT youth in a way that may not conflict with policy or doctrine. And I would highly recommend people look at that as a way to show leaders how they can, you know, if you will, better support LGBT youth in their congregations.
Amen.
All right. I want to do a little tease here to a program that we're putting together for next week. And we're going to invite you back, Kendall Wilcox. So one of the things we were talking about was the fact that when the handbook change came out in November, it was referred to as a policy change. Last month, President Russell M. Nelson. He's the president of the Quorum of the Twelve, one of the you know the key governing body within the Mormon Church. He gave this worldwide devotional broadcast to young adults of the church, and he said that this was not just a policy, this was a revelation. Now, for Mormons, that's a big deal. And that's a critical moment. And one of the things you've just revealed, in fact, this morning on your podcast, Out in Zion, is how that all worked out. Now, we don't have time to talk about the particulars of it, but give us a sense of what happened and why that's important and why people should listen next week.
Well, it's important because, to be honest, according to our research, that was the first time that a member of the Quorum of the Twelve or First Presidency evoked the language of revelation. And even quoted, there were a couple of phrases quoted by President Nelson in that address from the announcements and even the manifesto from President Kimball relating to the revelation on blacks and the priesthood. So that's why it's highly significant. And so the question that we go after in sharing these additional details about the story of how it came about is how does that impact our experience of trying to continue to support, sustain the leadership of the church, have faith in the functioning of the church, and what does it mean to faithfully question? Is this an act of faithfully questioning, or is it an act of, you know, speaking ill of the Lord's anointed, as it were, you know, in Mormon parlance? So that's where we come at it. And we want to see, does knowing more details, like, for example, knowing that there's seven versions of the first vision rather than just one, does that help our faith or does it actually attack our faith? And why?
Do you get to the question of whether or not this was whether the policy came about outside of the idea of normal protocol? Is that part of what you're talking about?
As best we can, right? Yeah. But what is normal protocol? That's the question.
Is there such a thing?
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I can't wait. Kendra Wilcox, again, co-chair of the Utah Commission on LGBT Suicide Awareness and Prevention. Thanks very much for being back with
Thanks,
us.
Thanks, Doug.
John Gustav Rothel, president of Affirmation, a support group for LGBT Mormons, joined us from a studio in Minneapolis. John, thanks to you.
Thank you very much, Doug.
And Dr. Philip Rogers, he is Vice President of Design Development and Evaluation for the group Living Works, joined us from his office in Rutland, Vermont. Dr. Rogers, thanks to you.
My pleasure.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. We have links to suicide crisis resources on our website, radiowest.org, and the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.